Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you all with us here. We're going to take a look at this anniversary of the Arab Spring that we are on the verge of. On January the 25th was the anniversary of the Tahrir Square demonstrations beginning in Egypt. Before that, of course, last month in December was the beginning of all this with the which we'll talk about later in the hour, which was the protests rising in Tunisia following the immolation that took place in the capital city. And we're following now in Egypt. We've been talking to people across Egypt for a long time on this program. They join us again today. We were glad to have you join us at 410-319-8888. We are here joined by Ghada Talhami, who is Emeritus Professor in the Department of Politics at Lake Forest College, author of The Mobilization of Muslim Women in Egypt and Palestine in the Egyptian Press. We are now joined also by Adaf Souif, one of Egypt's and the world's leading novelists, a political and cultural commentator, whose article I read in The Guardian last week that was one of the most striking looks, I thought, at what was going on in Egypt today. She joins us as well. And we're also now joined by Shahira Amin, who is a former deputy head of the state-run Nile TV and former contributor to CNN, also joining us from Egypt, as is Adaf. And folks, welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Hi.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. We have some tweets that came in at Mark Steiner, which we will read on the air. You can also log on to our Facebook pages, and we'll see what you have to say there as well. Let's just begin, Adaf. We talked on Friday for a bit and recorded something which we'll put up on our website so people can hear that one-on-one conversation we had.
Right.
But one of the things you were talking about was what might happen this weekend. Demonstrations did occur. Talk a bit about what you saw.
Firstly, the government and particularly the Minister of the Interior were urging people to go out and celebrate the 25th of January, which was really sad and ironic because, of course, the Ministry of the Interior is, I mean, the revolution on the 25th of January went out against the police. So to have the police telling people to go out and celebrate just showed what a terrible place we're in. There were people out waving flags and actually celebrating the general and his government and his possible candidacy for president. The protests, I was involved in the protests by the group, the Thawar group, the Revolutionary Road, the people who are saying no to the Brotherhood and no to the military. And there were supposed to be three protests. The first one got beaten up within 10 minutes of collecting. That was in a suburb of Cairo. And its people are at the moment in jail. And the second one that started half an hour later in another district in Cairo also got tear gassed. And so I went down to the third, and that was downtown. And it was quite strong. It was maybe 600-700 people, and the others from the other demonstrations were supposed to join us. Again, 15 minutes in. And we heard that the armored personnel carriers were gathering sort of in the next street. And so we started to move. And very quickly, there was gas and there was bullets. And as you know, there have been over 60 people killed on the streets on the 25th of January, people who were out there protesting. Certainly, what I saw was that protesters were unarmed, were peaceable, were chanting, and were attacked by army APCs. It also has to be said that the general sentiment in the street was to encourage the police to attack the demonstrators.
Encouraged by whom?
I'm saying that the sort of passers-by, as it were, or the people who were out to celebrate, I don't know what it is, to celebrate the official version of the revolution, were encouraging the police to round up and to beat and to tear gas and even to shoot the protesters who see themselves and I agree, as the true voice of the January 25 revolution. In other words, the people who insist on democracy and human rights and freedom and, you know, social justice and so on. So we have over 70 people killed, and we have hundreds of people who are now in jail, so-called pending investigation, but have been given two-week sentences. And meanwhile, they're supposed to be celebrating the revolution.
So let me explore this. I think one of the subjects that you've written a lot about, Adolf, and I think that we want to kind of really tackle with all three of you, is what happened. I mean, we covered Tahrir Square the moment it happened, with people from Egypt, people who were in the streets. It appeared, I mean, no matter what you felt at that moment, the military remained in tight control, and it always remained in tight control, even at the election of Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood. And I'd like to get all your analysis of what we think happened, how it all began to fall apart. And I want to talk to us about the kind of political divide that takes place in Egypt. Ghada, would you begin us off? Would you start us?
Well, I think the Egyptian people have demonstrated in large numbers that they actually reject the ideology of the Muslim Brotherhood. So the revolution, in a way, began to unravel and to become divided between two ideologies, really, the ideology of globalism and civil society versus the ideology of the Muslim Brotherhood. And, you know, the Tamarrud movement about a year ago, which came out a few months ago, which came out in the streets and demanded the removal of Morsi, could not have been ignored, and there's no in which to ignore it. Now, I agree very much that the military has been overreacting and has overreacted ever since. But I think it's because, in a way, there is a yearning in Egypt for stability, and stability brings out the army. And stability in this case means that the military is the last institution, really, that remained standing after the Morsi government dismantled the judiciary, tried to have a severe feud with Al-Azhar, downgraded women and Christian minorities, and the only institution, as a strong institution, remaining standing between the Muslim Brotherhood and the public was really the army. So it's unfortunate whatever has unfolded, and one wishes that the army would exercise more restraint. But I think a better question would be, what opportunities have been missed by the Muslim Brotherhood to reconcile to the new process? You know, there's something in Egypt called the roadmap, and the roadmap is that the Egyptian public are determined to pursue three steps. A consensus over a constitution, which they've already done, parliamentary elections and presidential elections. And we have just seen a reversed order whereby the presidential elections will precede parliamentary elections, again in a bid to create more stability and more strong rule. So there is a roadmap which should have been followed. And the Muslim Brotherhood just refused to cooperate from the beginning.
Well, you know, okay, I guess it's Shahira's turn, and then I'll come in.
Okay, so that was, you know, go ahead, Shahira, and then please come back with this.
I will.
Ghada?
Yes, Mark.
Is it, you're waiting for me to continue?
Yes, I was confused about who was talking at first. So that, we just heard from Ghada.
Yes, you know, I have no more really to say than to say that all of this is expected. The violence is a surprise. But the determination of people in the street to say no to this bankrupted ideology of the Muslim Brotherhood has to be taken into consideration and cannot be ignored. And if Morsi is to be restored tomorrow, I think we'll have more street violence and the same kind of street violence like before.
So I'm sorry, go ahead, Adolf.
Okay, well, Mark, look, the thing is that the army's role didn't start after the Muslim Brotherhood took over. I mean, we really need to be very clear about this, that the military took over officially. I mean, they were running things all along, but they took over officially on the 11th of February 2011. And at that point, there wasn't this division. There wasn't this polarization. In fact, the country had come together in a completely, it was unified, it was open-minded, it was going forward, it was looking for everything that was best in itself, and the people were out there. Every kind of political hue was out there in the streets, and they were very, very clear about what they wanted. They wanted a decent economy that was biased towards the majority. They wanted to be put on the road to social justice. They wanted freedom, i.e. human rights. They wanted basically a decent life. And that was what the entire country wanted. And it's recorded and we have banners saying it and so on. So the military comes in and says, okay, Mubarak is gone. We are going to run things and we are going to protect this revolution and we're going to safeguard this transition to the kind of country you want. Well, okay, it was possibly naive to believe them. And in fact, we were warned by people of an even older generation than me to not trust the army. But given the situation and given that the army is the army, like it's got weapons, and that the revolution was unarmed, and given that the old political leadership did not manage it wasn't the political leadership of the revolution, it was the political leadership that was in Egypt that had for a decade or two decades presented itself as the opposition to the regime, the young people turned to them to coalesce, to come together. If you remember, we tried to get Baradei and Hamdine Sabahi and, you know, all these sort of old political people to form a presidential council to stand up to the military to say, no, we will run the country. They didn't do it. And therefore, the military ran the country. Now, from that point on, the military was fighting the revolution. And let's remember that even in the heart of the 18 days in Tahrir, they were taking young people away into the museum and torturing them. People were being killed. And certainly from when they took over, they fought the revolution. And it was massacre after massacre, as they trained their personnel to, well, you know, basically to terrorize civilians, and as they brought the police back into the picture. And so their role for a year was fighting the revolution. So when the Brotherhood came into power, when they were elected to parliament, and when Dr. Morsi came to power, and when they performed really, really badly, and the country started to be totally polarized. Yes, this is the doing of the Muslim Brotherhood, but the military certainly paved the way. And since the takeover, now, of course, as Dr. Reda said, there was the Tamarrud campaign, there was the rebel campaign, and it started off genuinely enough. And people really did want to get rid of the presidency. But let's remember that the demand of the people, that the demand they signed for on the campaign leaflet was that they wanted early presidential elections. They did not ask the military to simply remove him. They said they wanted early presidential elections. Well, so the military removed him, and now the military is full out fighting any little spark of the ideas of the 25th of January, but dressing it up as continuing to protect the 25th of January.
So, Shahira, one of the things I would like you to comment on, and then we go into this conversation, is that there was just a piece that just came over the wire from BBC News saying that the Egyptian army mandates that Army Chief General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi run for president, according to the state media. And, Shahira, it seems to me that one of the things that gets lost in this sometimes is that from the moment that things erupted in Tahrir Square to the election of Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood as the majority party in Egypt to the coup that overthrew him to what's happening now is, it seems to me that that in all the confusion, the military has always been in power and never lost that power, Shahira.
The military has always been in power in Egypt, even when the Muslim Brotherhood president, when it was in power, they were ones pulling the string. And they were pulling it from behind, but now they're back up front. And the shameful thing is that the majority of Egyptians support this, and that's simply because they're tired. The last 3 years have been, you know, really exhausting for Egyptians. There's been no stability, no security. And I think that people have settled for that. They are willing to trade freedom and democracy for stability and just to lead normal lives and to be able to sustain their livelihoods.
So the real minority in all this, it seems to me, are the people, the young students, the workers and students who began the marches in Tahrir Square and other places, who are calling for a true democracy. Those are the ones, Ghada, that are losing out here, as well as the Egyptian people.
Young people are losing out.
Where are they today? They're behind bars, most of them.
And that is because he represents nationalism in a sense, and that in the views of many people now, you can say the desire for stability, it's actually a desire also for the triumph of nationalism over divisiveness in Egyptian life. So in a way, you have to remember that Sisi, according to people who met with him from the Tamarid movement, Mahmoud Badr and Mona Makram Abed and others, has actually asked them to put it in writing, that they asking the army to intervene. And you also have to remember that he offered Morsi the option of exile. He offered him actually to go to Turkey or to go to other countries in the Arab world, and he refused. So in a way, maybe the Egyptians are imagining that the army is the last resort. Now, whether Sisi runs for elections or not, I think we will always accuse him of being the manipulator behind the scenes. And that may be true. So maybe it's a better option, actually, to see him run into the elections, to run openly for higher office, and to see if he can really make it. Of course, it's desirable, and we hope this will happen, that this will be a clean election. But look, as Richard Falk has just written recently, what Egypt is really experiencing is populist democracy, rather than republicanist democracy as we see in Western countries. In other words, this is really an extreme situation where there is no room yet for a genuine peaceful democracy, not when the Muslim Brotherhood is using violence itself. We can't overlook that. They themselves are resorting to violence.
But
now it's a chance for elections. Let's see what the elections will bring up. And I was hoping actually myself that Sisi would not run. But then when you think about it, if he doesn't run, he will always be accused of being the man behind the scenes, the power behind the scenes.
But Adaf, I mean, from the beginning, though, I mean, the issue is, you've seen the explosions that took place last week, that many mm-hmm. people are saying is just the tip of the iceberg of what could explode because of the repression against the Muslim Brotherhood. That may not have occurred had an election taken place after Morsi's term was up. I mean, this is... We were talking about the people want stability, but the opposite could be happening, Adaf.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the people are going to get stability. And I think that one of the essential things that happened with the 25th of January 2011 was that people were questioning what stability looked like. I mean, what is stability to you if what it looks like is that you've nowhere to live and you've no job and you can't get health care? And so, you know, is that a stability that is desirable? So, you know, of course, now we've got these the actual terrorist attacks. I mean, the explosions and people killed in like the explosions, the four explosions that we had in Cairo on the 25th. And of course, yes, the sort of received true idea is that they wouldn't have happened if Morsi had been allowed to continue as president. I don't think that we, can sort of allow ourselves to be in a position where you're pushed by explosions to put somebody in power. But it's certainly true that what should have happened was that a national conversation should have taken place when people demanded that Morsi step down or that there is a referendum on having early presidential elections, so that would have been a kind of, if you like, a procedurally correct way to declare a vote of no confidence in the government, then whoever was in charge of the country, if they had steered it towards a conversation, towards people understanding that, you compromise a bit here and a bit there, and you finally arrive at something that doesn't give everybody everything they want, but gives everybody enough to be moving forward with, to be working together with. That was what was required. And what happened was a deeply, deeply divisive exercise, where from the beginning the military were sort of, you know, raining coupons for fridges and quilts down on people in one square of the city, and, you know, ignoring another or actually threatening another, and eventually they went in and killed them. So, you know, I mean, I don't think we're heading towards stability, really. We're heading towards an attempt to impose order with a very, very heavy hand. But that's not stability.
Shahira, we just had a tweet come in from Matthew Loftus, who said, I hope you'll discuss the implications of the Arab Spring for religious minorities. Could you speak to what's going on, Shahira?
Can you repeat that, Mark? I didn't hear you there.
I'm sorry. We just got a tweet in from Dr. Loftus asking, I hope you'll discuss the implications of the Arab Spring for religious minorities.
Religious?
Minorities.
Religious minorities.
Right.
That's all I heard, religious minority. Sorry.
Discussing the implications of the Arab Spring and what's going on now in terms of religious minorities.
The implications of the Arab Spring.
Yes, yes.
Well, it was clear that the majority of Egyptians don't want religion and politics mixed. And that is why millions took to the streets at the end of June, you know, refusing or rejecting the Muslim Brotherhood, the president. And now they're all throwing their weight behind General Sisi and endorsing a return to army rule. But the country is bitterly divided. We still have Morsi supporters taking to the streets, daily protests, and now the terror attacks, the bombings on Friday. We had four bombings in a row, and six people died that day. The next day we had more bombings. So there are jihadi groups supporting the Muslim Brotherhood, and I expect to see more violence in the coming days. So I agree with Ahdaf that the army will not be able to bring stability to this country. The only thing that can bring stability is reconciliation, is inclusiveness, is not sidelining a sizable portion of the population as is happening now.
I just want to come in here to remind everybody again that in the first year after the 25th of January 2011, the country showed that it wanted to move away from sectarianism, that there was very, very sort of overt and clear attempt to sort of bring people together, or for people to naturally come together. So we had all these sort of communal prayers in Tahrir, and it was really under Morsi's rule that the sectarian discourse rose again and was extremely bad, and churches started being burned and Christians started getting oppressed and so on. And now with the generals, it's the other way around. Men with beards are being dragged off the streets and beaten, and women, veiled women, are being dragged off the streets and beaten. And, you know, I mean, when our Christian friends were under attack, or when there was sectarian talk against them, a lot of us went actually and joined in mass for Christmas and for Easter of last year, and were tremendously welcomed by our friends there. This year, I didn't go because I felt something was going to happen that I wouldn't want to be part of. And It's true, it did happen. And at Mass, the congregation raised posters of General Sisi. And so it is all this that is, you know, really widening the sectarian divide, which the revolution really hoped to just put behind us and into the past.
We have to take a quick break, but I hope that the three of you can stay with us for another few minutes, because I want to kind of explore what you all think is next for Egypt. And I think that we have not explored that in depth, and what these bombings last week might mean for the future, and what a military regime will mean for the future. So can you all stay with us for a few more minutes?
Okay.
Great. We'll take a very brief break and come right back, and stay with us. Don't go away. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we will continue our conversation about Egypt into this last part of our program before we turn our attention to Tunisia and why Tunisia is so different. We are here with Shahira Amin, former deputy head of the state-run Nile TV and former contributor to CNN, Adaf Souif, who is one of the world's and Egyptian's leading novelists and a political and cultural commentator, and Gadat Halhami, emeritus professor in the Department of Politics at Lake Forest College, and you at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. Log on to our Facebook pages. But I'm very curious, given what we saw last week and the explosions and the attacks against the police stations, and that, you know, what this might portend for what comes next. And I saw the news reports this morning about, as you talked about earlier, Adaf, the pro-democracy, kind of anti-military, but also didn't want to see the Muslim Brotherhood in power, demonstrators taking place and how they were stopped, and the three demonstrations going on right now. What do you think comes next? Some people have said that America has failed the revolution. I'm not sure what America can do, but that would be interesting to hear what you think as well. But what do you think happens next, Adaf, and then we'll go to Shahira.
I think this notion of America failing the revolution is wrong. I think this was very much something that we had to do by ourselves and for ourselves. And America, I would say that the role that America would have to play would really be primarily in not selling or giving arms to whatever force in Egypt it is that uses them against us. You know, all those tear gas canisters coming in from Pennsylvania, for example, that would be the American role. Other than that, sort of, no, nothing. And as to what happens next, well, I think that Field Marshal, as he is now, Sisi, if he runs, he says he's going to let us know within a few hours. If he does run, then he will win by a landslide.
Mm-hmm.
And it will be genuine. They won't need to, rig the elections or anything. He'll genuinely get a landslide. And then we'll see what he chooses to do. I mean, he might choose to carry on exerting sort of control with, you know, iron and fire and pushing the police further into brutalizing the people and so on. Or he might actually, sort of having been voted into power, decide to turn around and do something for history and for the country. It's down to him and the Supreme Council for the Armed Forces now. So it's very hard to say because everything changes minute to minute. But what is not going to go away is the fact that any government that comes in, whoever it is headed by and whoever popular they are at the outset, if quite soon it doesn't look like it's going to do something for the majority of the people whose need is extremely dire and who find it very difficult to carry on from day to day, then there's going to be more turbulence. And also any government that comes in and doesn't try and work out some solution with the different factions in society beyond locking them up and killing them on the streets is going to find that the country becomes more and more a target for extreme ideas and for violent acts. So, you know, it's something that is just kind of preordained, as it were. It's the way history goes.
Let's go to Gada very quickly, and then Shahira before we have to move on to Tunisia.
Well, if the general wins with a landslide, I think it really portends ill for Egypt, because as Mandela has always preached, any government that comes in with an overwhelming majority risks being accused of tyranny of the majority, as Tocqueville has said, and it's not good for you. I mean, Mandela used to say he didn't want the ANC to win overwhelmingly, that the opposition should enjoy a healthy representation in the government. But I think that's up to the Egyptian people now. And I'm placing my faith in the interim government, which is a government of technocrats, which true has been appointed by the military, but has been very steady so far. And I don't absolve the Muslim Brotherhood of any blame, as your two other guests have done, because I think all you have to do is to read their foremost ideologue, Assam El-Aryan, to see how determined they were not to have anything to do with Egyptian ordinary democratic politics after the removal of Morsi. They have been offered to come in the government and they refused. They decided to take over certain quarters of Cairo until the government decided to use violence. And from then on, then there was no conversation. But I do think that Egyptians should bear in mind the experience of Tunisia, where really you have now a long, long protracted conversation between al-Nahda and between the rest of civil society, between the Islamic Party and civil society, and it seems to be getting somewhere. So the question is time. Do people have time? And of course, we can never compare Egypt to Tunisia because the army in Tunisia never played a role in politics, is not powerful. And in Tunisia, what you're dealing with really is the Nahda, the Islamic Party, versus unions. That is really civil society with all of its varieties. So I don't think it's a fair comparison between the two countries. That's why I would object from the beginning to this big grand label of the Arab Spring, whereas it's really different from one country to the other. But, I agree with the person who tweeted you that the Christian, especially the Christian minorities in Egypt, have really suffered so far. And that has been grating with a lot of decent people in Egypt who want to see an end to this huge sectarian divide between Muslim and Christian.
So let me turn for a closing thought to Shahira Amin and your sense of where we are and the future, what may be coming.
The future, Mark, I think that things are going to get a lot worse before they get better, more violence. And as I said before on your show, that violence can only breed violence. And if the military-backed government continues with the arrests, detentions, the killings, and the brutal crackdown, not just on Muslim Brotherhood supporters, but on liberal activists as well, well, then, you know, we're going to continue this vicious cycle. And so I hope that, you know, the repression stops, and that is the only way we can have stability. You know, pluralism is the answer. I congratulate Tunisia on their constitution, and I think they did the right thing. What happened in Egypt was a warning to them, and they avoided our mistakes, and they're on track, I think. The only Arab Spring country that is on track towards achieving democracy. I also don't want to see the young people excluded. They are the ones that brought about the change, and they have to be included in the political sphere.
Shahira Amin, it's always wonderful to talk to you, former deputy head of the state-run Nile TV and former contributor to CNN. Great to have you with us with your thoughts. Gada Talhami, good to have you with us as well. Emeritus professor in the Department of Politics at Lake Forest. And Adaf Suif, a pleasure to have you with us. We'll be linking to some of the work you've just been writing over the last few weeks on our website. You've been writing some incredibly powerful, interesting stuff. And look forward to talking to you again and once again very soon.
Thank you so much, Mark. Good to talk to you.
We're going to take a very brief break. And when we come back, we're going to see what is going on where Arab Spring began in Tunisia. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we turn our attention now to where all this began. One of the things we're very clear about in these conversations is that there is no Arab monolith. It's different across the globe and across the Arab world. We're here with Masoud Rumdani, who is a human rights activist in Tunisia, Dr. Florence Martin, a professor of French and Francophone Literature and Film at Goucher College, who spends a great deal of time in Tunisia, and Dr. Florence Martin and Masoud Rumdani. Welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Hi, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Masoud, let me begin with you, joining us from Tunisia. A lot has been made about the differences, about what happened in Tunisia and it happened across the rest of the Arab world. And before I get into kind of the pain and power of the struggle still going on, one of the things people say to me a lot, I've been reading a lot about, is the power of the unions in Tunisia, how they made a difference. But what do you see as the difference?
Well, thank you very much for the invitation. First of all, I have to say that it's not the union who are really powerful. but the whole civil society in Tunisia. Remember that Tunisia is a pioneer in the Arab Spring, and then, first of all, that it was thanks to the UNO, but thanks to the civil society. We have the civil society that is going ahead of politics in Tunisia and that has played an important role in the first draft, the second, third, and fourth draft of the constitution. So it has changed much, and we have not gone a long way through that constitution. And I think, yeah, there is a difference between... I think that the civil society also in Egypt is quite strong, but then, again, we have the army who really played a different role, and then I think it's not really a very good role anyway. But in Tunisia, the army, as the lady who was speaking before me, the army in Tunisia does not play a role in politics. So we are lucky to have the civil society that changes the whole thing and has played an important role. The civil society, along with and the head of the civil society, yes, I believe that the union that has played for decades an important role in changing the way things are in Tunisia.
Florence, I'm glad you can join us. Good to have you with us.
Thanks.
Talk about your analysis of why you think it's so different, and what your analysis of what makes Tunisia stand out from the other countries that have experienced this Arab Spring, and why democracy at least seems to be moving in a certain direction.
Well, I would agree with the other Tunisian speaker, whom I salute and congratulate in the name of your country for having finally given birth to that amazing constitution. It is full of contradictions, by the way, the constitution, but I do think that, yes, this is civil society played an amazing role, and perhaps one, for me, very dear point is that women's voices were heard, which doesn't seem to be the case in Egypt. So that's one.
Now, why do you think that is?
Well, traditionally, you know, Tunisia has had most rights for women, but not completely equal rights. And this constitution is you know, trying to break that and really give equal rights, even though it is going to go against some heritage problems with the Muslim law. But I think we're really getting there, and the women were heard, because civil society was given a large place in the debate around the constitution.
That's a really interesting analysis. Masu, would you pick up on that thought?
Well, I think there are historic reasons. Remember that in Tunisia that we didn't have political parties who really can oppose the government. So what people did, in fact, through the decades, that the past decades, is that they integrated the unions and human rights organizations. So that's why that is really something very good, and something that might be bad, something good, because they have learned tolerance through these associations and through the unions, but at the same time, we don't have a very strong, really political party that can really stand.
So we're going to try to give Masoud the call back on his line in Tunisia, because we had a little break up there, and make sure that we can hear all the cogent, important things he's saying. I think that, you know, I think, again, one of the things we do in this country a lot, Florence Martin, is to we take the Arab world and we make this monolith out of it, as if every society is the same, every part of the Arab culture is the same, when clearly when you see what's going on around the world, they're very different, different influences, different histories.
Yes, indeed, very, very different. And I think Tunisia, you know, it's been a very long, sad process for them. There's not been as much violence as in Egypt, if we want to keep comparing, but the civil society really came together in order to, you know, right after the two murders of opponents in the last year, and reacted, the entire people reacted, and that worked, which I don't think would work in Egypt, for instance.
You say you don't think it would work in Egypt?
No.
Because?
No, well, because, okay, you have a difference between Ennahda and the rest in Tunisia, but really Ennahda, if you look at, which is the party that was in power, Islamist, if you look at the number of people who voted, and even though the majority, they got the majority votes, they represented not a majority in the people of Tunisia. because some people didn't vote and so on. So that bloc was not as powerful as it was, and then it got completely dissociated and from the Salafists, from the, you know, the fringe that was really a terrorizing fringe. That, first of all, occupied most of the discourse in Tunisia and sort of hijacked the political discourse for a while. And then the civil society said, no, enough of this. And I'm not sure. And if you look at Egypt, then you have the brothers on the one hand, and I'm really not being very subtle in that, and then the army, and that's it, the two big forces, and there's no room, it sounds like, for public debate.
Masoud, it was just announced that we just saw on the coming through the wire that the Tunisian parliament has voted to... after voting each article, voted yes on the Constitution. That just happened, apparently. But I wonder, one of the things I've been reading about from some dissidents in Tunisia and some of the pieces I was reading over the weekend is that Tunisia's recovery is kind of so tied to the International Monetary Fund that people worry about what that future might bring. What's your thought about that? I'm sorry, Masoud, we're having a hard time with the connection, so our producer's going to try to give a call back and try this one more time and see if we can get this to work right. I do apologize. Florence, let me throw back to you then. I'm sorry. What are your thoughts on that?
The economy is in shambles right now, so they need something fast. But I'm not a good economist. I'm not sure I can completely respond to your question. What I can tell you, though, is that I've reread the Constitution article by article this morning, and it's amazing what's in there. There is even something about protecting the future generations. The government is responsible for sustainability. Everybody has a right to water. I mean, there are things like that I have never seen anywhere.
Yeah, so what is that? I mean, I'm curious, and when we get Masoud Ramdani back on the phone, we'll ask him the same thing. But I mean, I wonder, you're a student of Tunisian life and history. What is fundamentally different about how Tunisia was organized or formed or about its history that allows it to get to the place it is now?
That question is to me.
Yes, Masoud, you're back. Why don't you take that? Go right ahead. Then we'll go back to Flo. Go ahead. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, historically speaking, Tunisia is really more near the Mediterranean than any other place. That's the first thing. Huh. Remember that Tunisia, through history, has had the first constitution in the Arab world. Second, remember that the status of women is different from the Arab world through history. So another thing is that since the independence, although Bourguiba was a dictator, but then he was an eliminated, he was an enlightened dictator. So he allowed education of a sort, more or less, of Western education. And through its history, we have a union that had a history of playing not only a role as a union, but also it has played a role in the national fight against colonization, etc.
So before we went back to Florence, I asked you this question about the International Monetary Fund, and we were breaking up, so we couldn't hear your response, that some of the people I've been reading are saying that in the long run, this could hurt Tunisia.
Well, yeah. I mean, things are getting, the economy is really falling down, cracking down, and et cetera, yeah. But then again, I remember that the Monetary Fund also said that economy is going to go back again, and things are going to get quiet, and investment are going to be back in Tunisia, and the calm is going back, and then things are going to be better. I'm sure that things are going to change in the future. It all depends on the political situation.
But are you more hopeful or more pessimistic about what's going to happen?
Because I believe in the role of civil society. I believe that Tunisians now are aware more than any time in the past that they have to go back and to work, and they have gained experience, political experience, and things are going to be better.
And Florence, I know you've gone back and forth, so I'm very curious about your sense of where it is and the people you've talked to there and what they're saying to you.
They're very hopeful.
I've gone back to Florence. Come right back to you, Masoud.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
It's all right.
The people I've talked to yesterday were very hopeful. They were describing, you know, immense joy, even though, because it is a work of consensus, you know, not everybody is super pleased with the results, but there is the idea that there is a real constitution. People told me the best Arab constitution ever, perhaps even rivaling Western ones, and on some articles I would say yes, absolutely. And the sense that they are finally out of this morass and about to have a very secure country that might attract tourists and so on and so forth, and that the economy will go back.
It was interesting to hear what you were saying earlier, Masoud, about the kind of the complexity of Tunisian political life and history that has made a difference in Tunisia. You also saw, though, that there were eruptions between people who view Islam in a more fundamentalist way. That isn't that still a great tension point inside of Tunisia?
I'm sorry, I cannot hear very well. Would you repeat that, or just?
Just very quickly, when you read about what's going on in Tunisia and read about the reaction of people who look at Islam in a much more fundamentalist way, that's still a point of tension inside of Tunisia.
Well, it is. I mean, fundamentalism exists. I mean, it is part of the Islamism that exists. But then again, it depends. I believe that the Islamist party in the future is going to be later on divided because of its complexity, and then because of the real issues and the challenges in Tunisia, there is going to be divided into a fundamentalist party and then a party that is more tolerant, and then it's going to accept the real challenges of Tunisia and to view out a place among political parties.
So it does seem, sometimes when I look at what's going on in Tunisia, it reminds me a little bit of Turkey, the flow, just in terms of the openness of people to kind of try to wrestle with these issues, even if they become very dogmatic and fight for their position. There's something at play here that's different.
No, I'm sorry. I think Tunisia is totally different from Turkey. I mean, here in Tunisia, we have more open society, and then the political parties are different. I mean, Nahda is different from the party in Turkey. And then again, who is going to decide the future of Tunisia is not the Islamist party. Who is going to decide the future of Tunisia is this vibrant civil society that is going to decide how the future of Tunisia is going to be.
That's right. And this civil society has been amazingly vigilant the entire time since the revolution. It's January 2011.
Absolutely. I mean, remember the first draft of the constitution in Tunisia was really, there was Sharia, there was the complementarity between men and women, and then we have gone a long way through history to change all that into a better constitution.
Yeah.
And you know, Florence, I think that we began this conversation, it'd be a good way to kind of close it out with you, both your thoughts on this. I think that, you know, as our listeners and others here in the United States look at what comes next throughout the Arab world, is for us to really understand and the unique differences between various Arab cultures, their interactions with other cultures, what made them what they are. And I think that I think this is important because I want to kind of again disrupt the notion of this monolith, Florence.
Well. It's an Arab world because what? There's an Arab-Muslim culture, but a language, even though I'm not sure that Palestinians understand Tunisians, in colloquial Arabic. But there is a very big difference for each country. It has its own. I mean, look at Tunisia, sandwiched in between Algeria and Libya. And there is no commonality in the way it is governed, in the way civil society functions or doesn't in Libya, for instance, and so on and so forth. And people need to really, I agree with you, Mark, have a lot of subtlety in looking at each country and trying to see what they are for each country, each region even.
Well, I want to thank both of you. This has been a great conversation. We look forward to talking more. We just heard Dr. Florence Martin, who is a professor of French and Francophone Literature and Film at Galcher College, and Masoud Ramdani, who is a human rights activist in Tunisia. Great to have you both with us. Thank you so much, and good luck to Tunisia.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're welcome. Thank you.
On our way out the door today, I want to remind you the Mark Sanders Show is brought to you in part via the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at marylandeducators.org. That's one word, marylandeducators.org. Or you can go to MarkSteinerShow.org and click on their banner that is on our website. Thank you all for joining us today. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andrea Melton. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cut. You can find information about our guests and podcasts, other shows, by just going to SteinerShow.org on the web. You can also listen to and download all of our podcasts on iTunes. And going out right now, we are going out with Roller Coaster. And for public radio, to be EAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.